Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. Well, 3 weeks ago, we had a presidential election here in the United States, but now, lo, these many weeks later, the result is still somewhat open to question. This past weekend, on Sunday, the Secretary of State of Florida said that Governor Bush had won the state of Florida by 537 votes out of nearly 6 million cast. Almost immediately, representatives for the vice president filed suit in circuit court in Florida, arguing that the vote totals certified on Sunday were wrong because of problems in three counties, in Palm Beach, where they didn't finish their recount, in Miami-Dade, where they said initially they would do a manual recount but then changed their minds, and in Nassau, where they did a machine recount but rejected the result and then went back to the initial count from Election Day. So that is now pending in circuit court there in Florida, and the judge apparently has at least said he will consider what the Gore representative have asked for. Also this week, the U.S. Supreme Court will become involved, reviewing the decision that was made by the Supreme Court of the state of Florida to extend the deadline and give counties a chance to do these manual recounts. We'll try and talk a little bit about where we've come from, where we are, and where we seem to be heading with this morning with two guests. Both of them have been on our air before. Brian Gaines, he's professor of political science. He's been on this show before. He was with us election night to do some analysis. And also Jim Fander, he's professor of law. And he's been on the show before to talk about legal issues and specifically about the Supreme Court. And questions, of course, are welcome. All we ask of people calling in is that you just try to be brief so we can get in as many folks as possible. But anyone's welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Well, thank you both very much for being here. Perhaps one place we might start is by talking a little bit about what's going to be happening in the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, on Friday. And as I understand it, basically what the lawyers from Mr. Bush are arguing is that this decision that the Florida Supreme Court made to extend the deadline for the counting after the election, essentially they said, you can't do that. You cannot change the laws regulating elections after the election has taken place. I guess the very first question is, and I think that there are some people who were surprised that the court agreed to take the case at all. Why is it that a court that has expressed a lot of sympathy for the concept of states' rights has decided to get involved in what seems to be an issue that should be settled by the court of the state of Florida?
Well, that's a good question. As you know, the Supreme Court of the United States ordinarily addresses questions of federal law. That is to say, the interpretation of federal statutes, the interpretation of the federal constitution, and doesn't involve itself in disputes over the meaning of state law. So there's at least an argument in this case that the Florida Supreme Court decision involving, as it does, an interpretation of Florida election law just doesn't present any kind of federal question that would support review in the Supreme Court of the United States at all. And it certainly is, I think, was surprising to some observers that the court agreed to take the case in view of the fact that you have to look pretty hard to find the federal questions involved in this case. Certainly the Bush team understood the need to identify federal questions in its petition for review in the Supreme Court of the United States, and it has identified two that the Supreme Court has agreed to hear. The first involves the interpretation of a federal election statute, Title III of the U.S. Code, Section 5, and the second federal question deals with the interpretation of Article II of the Constitution, a provision of Article II which provides that the state legislature shall choose the electors of the state. And in effect, what the Bush crew argues is that the Florida Supreme Court decision was so inconsistent with the rules laid down by the Florida legislature that it violates the requirements of both the statute Title III of the U.S. Code and of Article II of the Constitution, which, according to Bush's lawyers, gives primacy to the Florida legislature and leaves the Florida Supreme Court out of the determination of electors. Mm-hmm. So those are the two federal questions that provide the hook for Supreme Court involvement. They were not issues that the Florida Supreme Court spent a great deal of time addressing. In fact, they were dealt with, if at all, only glancingly in Bush's brief to the Florida Supreme Court and in the Florida Supreme Court opinion. So one could characterize the case as a state dog with a federal tail.
Mm-hmm. And for their part, the Gore lawyers, is it that they're simply arguing that when you look at the way the law is written in Florida, it does allow the state Supreme Court to do what they did, that they simply are doing their job of interpreting the law and that that essentially they should be left alone to do that?
Yeah, that's essentially it. They say that as most states and the federal government do, the power to interpret the laws assigned to the judicial branch of the government, and that's true in Florida as it is in the United States. So the legislature makes the law and the Florida courts interpret the law. What the Florida Supreme Court did in the decision that is under review in the Supreme Court of the United States is to attempt to harmonize two inconsistent or apparently inconsistent provisions of Florida election law, one that said that certification is required on a date certain by the Secretary of State, and one that suggested that the Secretary might ignore a certification and apparently gave the Secretary some discretion. It was the apparent conflict between those two legislative provisions in Florida, in the Florida election statutes, that the Florida court was interpreting when it reached its conclusion about how to structure the certification process. What Bush's team would argue is that in creating a new deadline, and here the Bush lawyers would point to the November 26th deadline, which nowhere appears in the statute. The statute says 7 days from the date of the election or November 14th, that the act of creating that new deadline in the exercise of judicial equity was a legislative act and intrudes into the role of the legislature.
Am I correct that the Bush lawyers had one other question which the court did not agree to hear, which was a vote dilution issue?
Yes, they did. They had presented both an equal protection and a due process issue, federal question issues, to the federal court in Florida, the federal district court, seeking preliminary injunctive relief against the recounts, arguing that any manual recount was so arbitrary and unfair that it would both violate Governor Bush's due process rights and also dilute the votes of other voters in Florida, violating their equal protection rights under the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Those are obviously both federal questions. So the federal courts have a role to play there. Both the federal trial court and the federal appellate court, the 11th Circuit, expressed little interest in providing preliminary injunctive relief for either of those alleged violations. The Bush team took that issue up to the Supreme Court in the Siegel case, and the court has not granted cert in that case. That case remains pending. The Bush lawyers also presented the questions of due process and equal protection to the Supreme Court in their petition for review of the Florida Supreme Court decision, and it was that issue that the Supreme Court of the United States refused to grant cert on or refused to grant review on, so that issue is not before the court and won't be argued on Friday.
This is one of the things I find interesting about this current impasse is that there are two prongs to to both sides' attack. There's a legal and a public opinion one. And in the public opinion side, various Republican spokesmen, Jim Baker and others, are still very much playing up the arbitrariness of hand recounts and reminding people about vote counters holding ballots up to see if they can see the light and the sort of preposterousness of dimpled and pregnant chads. The terminology is even more preposterous than the item itself. But there's a set of legal arguments, and meanwhile they're still running with the arguments that they think play best in public opinion, and they aren't necessarily the same ones.
Mm-hmm. Well, given the fact that it seems maybe the arguments on the political and public opinion side are running a little bit ahead of the legal ones, does that somewhat render moot anything that the court would decide. And then, of course, there's another layer on this that says, well, what's happening in the Florida courts? Does that render moot anything that the U.S. Supreme Court would decide?
Well, there's a question about whether the Supreme Court of the United States has a role to play in umpiring this dispute. The only issue before it is the grant of injunctive relief by the Florida Supreme Court restraining the Secretary of State from certifying the election before the date it specified, November 26th. As you know, that date has come and gone. The Secretary of State has certified, and now there are post-certification contests ongoing in the Florida state courts, and you sketch them at the outset of the program. With that in mind, there's some question about what, if anything, the Supreme Court of the United States can do by way of remedy, even if it agrees with the Bush team that there was something wrong in the way Florida's Supreme Court interpreted Florida law, something so wrong that it presents a federal question that they could umpire. In fact, instead of hearing the vote dilution and due process claims that the Bush team offered in its petition for review, the Supreme Court directed the parties to brief and argue the question of what remedy the court could provide if it found that the Florida Supreme Court had violated federal law. So there's a substantial question about whether events will have simply run away with the Supreme Court by the time it does anything in this case. And I think it relatively unlikely that the Supreme Court of the United States is going to provide decisive guidance for the future of this ongoing dispute. I think it may provide some guidance on the particular issues that are presented, but I would expect in the expedited environment in which it is acting that it would be slow to take a crack at the broader issues that are presented. Indeed, would perhaps view that it, you know, understand its role as limited to the litigation and the adjudication and the resolution of the particular issues that have been presented.
Yeah. I wonder on the political side, when you think about what it is that is motivating the Gore camp to do what they're doing, again, it seems to me that there are several levels one can look at. Mr. Gore himself, we are told, believes that he won. And I'm certain that after you go all the way through the campaign, you get to the end, you don't walk away that easy. Also, there are all of those various Democratic activists across the country. And one presumes that the Gore campaign is also continuing to fight, in a sense, on their behalf, because they also don't want to give up. Then there's the court of public opinion generally, where it seems that slowly the number of people who, if you're going to believe surveys, the number of people who say, well, we think probably Mr. Gore is just going to have to throw in the towel, slowly is starting to creep up. And at least the last thing that I heard was that it was slightly more than half of the people surveyed said they think Mr. Gore is going to have to give up. How does one balance all of those various things? You know, what you want as a candidate, what the people who worked hard for you want, and then what everybody else seems to want.
Well, this is a challenge for both candidates at the moment, but it's more pressing for Gore because at the moment Bush is the default president, having been certified in Florida. The people you left out are actually the congressional Democrats, who for the moment are standing behind Gore united, but they have quite a strong incentive really to at this point to recede and let Bush be president. Just on historical precedent, there have been only two midterm elections this century where the party of the presidency did not lose congressional seats. 1998 was one of them, so we just had one. The other was right after the New Deal, 34. Every other time there's an election, just 2 years following a presidential election, whoever's in the White House, that party loses seats. So if George Bush is, in fact, the president in 2 years' time, I think the Democrats can look forward to big gains in both houses. And with the houses almost exactly tied, Democratic leaders probably secretly and perhaps in private speaking to Gore at this point really have quite a strong incentive to say, all right, you gave it a good try. It was a very close election, but maybe 4 years from now you'll get another kick at it. In the meantime, we're going to rub our hands together just waiting for this retaking both houses of Congress in 2002. Hmm. So I think for the moment it's impressive the degree to which congressional Democrats haven't started to add to the rumblings of saying enough's enough, Al, give it up. But if you could inject them with truth serum, I think most of them at this point really would like Bush to take the White House and they want to move on.
Is Mr. Gore now first in line for the Democratic nomination in 2004?
Well, it's something of a fool's game to predict nominees four years in advance. If he loses, I think that counts against him. Right? There's the Richard Nixon example that you might come back. It might take 8 years. But parties are a little wary of going to the same person twice. It hasn't worked well in the past. Adlai Stevenson pops to mind. So he's out of a job if he doesn't get the presidency now. One reason perhaps he's fighting as desperately as he is, he's not a governor like George Bush. He can go back to the governor's mansion and plot. He's more likely to head off to a think tank or the board of several corporations or something. So in that respect, I think he's a little bit desperate because he's afraid that he probably isn't next in line.
We have a couple of callers. We'd invite others. Let me introduce again our guest for this morning. Last person you heard, that's Brian Gaines. He's professor of political science at University of Illinois. Also with us, Jim Fander, who's professor of law. If you have questions, comments, they're welcome. Again, we just ask people to, you know, try and be brief just so we can keep things moving along. But anyone is welcome to call him. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. Starting in Freeport, line number 4. Hello.
Yeah.
Yes.
The media, in my estimation, is since the election is slanting the reports decidedly toward Butcher Bush, the guy carried out some 126 executions in Florida. I mean, in Texas, and while his brother's ruling in Florida, and Radio Havana, Cuba states that thousands of voters in Dade County have been effectively disqualified because they wouldn't count the votes there. They wouldn't do the recount there. It seems to me this is a clear case of vote fraud on the part of the Republicans nationwide.
Can you? I'm just curious because you said that you thought that the coverage was slanted towards Governor Bush. Can you just give some examples in of how you think something concrete of how you think that's the case?
You just said a few minutes ago that you had a report that over 50% of the people think that Gore should give up. Now, I mean, this is just, to me, this is just hearsay. Just like those polls that said Truman was going to be defeated by Dewey in 48. Same kind of stuff.
Well, okay. You have some reaction to what the call is?
It seems to me, I watch all the network commentators, Rather and Jennings, all those people, NBC, ABC, CBS, they're all slanting their reports to the public toward Bush, Butcher Bush.
It won't surprise me if a later caller calls and complains that the media are slanted towards Gore. I mean, it's a very common complaint the media are biased one way or another. In this case, the poll you mentioned, I mean, the caller has one point that one has to be careful about the wording, that you can get 65% of the people saying they're tired of the impasse, but some of those people ask a different question, should there be a fair recount? We'll say, yes, there should be. And so there's some ambiguity about survey results, but I don't think it's easy to make the case that the media as a whole has shown a preference for Bush. And certainly Republicans were apoplectic election night about early calls in favor of Gore and the apparent slow calls in favor of Bush in states that he won by a large margin, Georgia and Colorado. So they've been howling about media bias for sort of a different set of facts, but the same kind of complaint that somehow journalists are showing a preference to Gore and are trying to help push Gore into the White House.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that's struck me about the discussion is just how hard it is for anyone, even the supposedly neutral judges that are sitting to decide all these election disputes, how difficult it is for anyone to divorce their sense of the law from their sense of the politics involved. I think this is a case in which one's assessment of the legal issues is likely to line up pretty closely with one's assessment of the two candidates, and that has been, to me, the most striking feature of the legal development so far.
Mm. Well, specifically, then, when you take a look at what the Supreme Court of the state of Florida has done, it has been pointed out that all of the justices, I think, save one, are Democrats. Can one argue that their decisions have been partisan?
One can certainly make the argument, and representatives of Governor Bush have certainly not wasted any words in making those arguments and in characterizing the Florida Supreme Court as a partisan collection of jurists who were just basically hewing to the Democratic Party line. In a sense, that is one of the contributions that the Supreme Court of the United States might be able to make here. In its review of the Florida Supreme Court decision. If the Florida Supreme Court decision was really as bad as it has been portrayed by Bush's lawyers and representatives, then perhaps one would expect the Supreme Court of the United States to get concerned and get involved. And if the Supreme Court of the United States stays its hand, or in other words, affirms the Florida Supreme Court, it may give the Florida Supreme Court a measure of additional neutral legitimacy and strengthen the Florida Supreme Court's hand in future disputes, if there are some, about the meaning of Florida law or its relationship with the Florida legislature.
I was going to say briefly, the Florida Supreme Court justices have a partisanship attached to them. So does the Secretary of State. So the people have been complaining this Republican Secretary of State is being partisan. The United States doesn't really have much of a tradition of nonpartisan officials. Occasionally, a courts appoint special masters who are supposed to be somehow above the parties. But most of the election positions, the officials who are involved in deciding how an election turned out are, in fact, partisans and have been through the history of the country. Places where there's a tradition of nonpartisan returning officers often have scandals and allegations of fraud because a supposedly nonpartisan official was really, in fact, partisan. So I think it's almost inescapable.
Let's talk with another caller here. This is Champaign County, and it's line one.
Yeah. Do we know which four Supreme Court people opted to have this? Is that something that's public record? I haven't seen that anywhere.
No, they don't.
Okay. That's not what I wanted to call about, but I didn't think we knew.
No.
I don't know if you saw the article in the Times 2 days after the election. Was titled Republicans like something to the effect Republicans appreciate manual recounts when it goes their way or something. That's actually a little bit biased, but in Seminole County there was a selective precinct recount, manual recount that gained 98 votes for Bush. So 98 votes of his 500 some margin is from a manual recount. It seems to me the height of hypocrisy that they're still drumbeating this manual recounts aren't good. This was in the Times the Thursday after the election, and then somebody's been writing in both the local paper here last Sunday saying more details about it that I hadn't heard, which is that there was some kind of deadline that the Secretary of State allowed to be extended so that they could finish that manual recount in Seminole County. Do you know any of the specifics of any of this? Have you heard about this at all?
I have heard that Seminole County has been identified as a place where some shenanigans may have gone on that supported.
That's something else. That's absentee ballots that were pre-filled out for people, I guess, since there's so many people, so many snowbirds in Florida, and so many people that aren't there, that they have a company that actually pre-fills out the form, and they got the form wrong. But that's not it. This is a manual recount that was agreed at the county level in Seminole County that gained 98 votes for Bush.
I've seen a reference to that in the papers that the Gore lawyers filed with the Supreme Court of the United States. They also make the point that Florida law specifically provides for manual recounts. It doesn't specify how those manual recounts should proceed, so it doesn't say that the canvassing board, for example, should give more weight to the hanging chad than to the dimpled chad or the like.
Whereas the Texas law does.
Whereas the Texas law does, right. There's a lack of specificity there, but there is a specific provision for manual recounts, and I guess it's not particularly surprising to me to learn that that the Republicans sought a manual recount and may have benefited from one.
Yeah, apparently the vice chair or whatever he's called of the Republican Party for all of Florida was quite eloquent in talking about how it was a good process, et cetera. It's quite amazing that it isn't being visited anywhere. I have to run now. Thanks.
All right. Thank you for the call. Let me just again real quick reintroduce our guests. We're here about the midpoint of the show. We're talking with Jim Fander and Brian Gaines. Brian Gaines, professor of political science, and Jim Fander, professor of law, both from the University of Illinois, just talking about where things stand in the presidential contest. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Back again here to Champaign, line number two. They're next in line. Hello.
Hi. I'd like your caller, your guest, to address something I read in the paper that really scared me. There was a quote from Representative Bill Archer of Texas, who said that if Al Gore somehow came out the winner in this, that the Republican Congress would not ratify the election. And I believe the quote was something along the lines of, if you thought we had a constitutional crisis with the impeachment, wait until you see this. And I just sort of sat up and took notice and got really worried. And I would like your guest to address this. And I'll just hang up and listen.
All right.
I didn't see the exact quotation, but there has been some saber-rattling from various Republicans, and I guess Tom DeLay circulated a memo amongst Republicans on how they might proceed if the opportunity does arise for them to vote in the House not to accept the Electoral College vote or the Florida slate of electors. I take most of this to be cheap talk. I don't think it's likely to we're likely to see these events transpiring. It does portend a very messy session of Congress to come. The fact that both parties have been quite so unanimous and quite so free with the rhetoric about theft of the election and allegations about their fraud on both sides make it seem very likely that the next session is going to start with quite a bitter tone and a very very divided House. And whoever's president, Gore or Bush, is going to have to be masterful in somehow or other papering over this. I don't know how he's going to pull it off.
The same sort of thing might happen in Florida itself, actually. The Florida Supreme Court might interpret laws in ways that produce an outcome favorable to Gore ultimately if the recounts proceed and the Florida Supreme Court ultimately affirms their inclusion in the final count and overturns the certification of the Secretary of State. The Florida legislature has indicated that in such a case it might be interested in rethinking the question of how to select electors for the state of Florida, and there might be a question about which slate of electors go to Congress or which slate of electors' vote should be counted at the counting process when the votes of the electors appear in Congress in January. When Congress reconvenes. At that point, I suppose it's at least possible that the Republican Congress could take matters into its own hands, but I like Brian, believe that that's a fairly unlikely scenario at this point.
Well, if just, again, here we're dealing in hypotheticals, but if that would happen, supposing that the court rulings go in favor of Mr. Gore, then the legislature of Florida comes along and says, well, we're not going to sit still for that. We're going to put in electors that will cast their votes for Mr. Bush, therefore giving him the presidency. Would that action of the Florida legislature be open to challenge? Could the representatives of Mr. Gore come along and in some way attempt to have that overturned?
Well, that presents two very tricky questions of constitutional law that we don't really have much guidance on. These are issues that we might learn something about from the Supreme Court's resolution of the current dispute. The Constitution says that the state shall choose electors in the manner that the legislature may direct. And so it's at least conceivable that the legislature might simply direct that the electors be chosen at an election held in the well of the Florida legislature. Or they might, as they have done, provide by law that the electors shall be chosen based on the popular vote that's certified through the ordinary processes of certification subject to whatever contests occur. I think it's uncertain at this point the extent to which the Florida legislature would be permitted to step into the breach at the last minute, change the rules of Florida law governing the selection of electors, and then insist on the use of this new slate of electors for the casting of any votes reflecting the 25 electors that Florida has in hand. Interestingly, President Bush's legal position before the Supreme Court of the United States may put him in a difficult position if that issue were ever to arise, because he's arguing to the Supreme Court in briefs this week that all the games have to be played in accordance with the rules laid down as of the date of the election, and that federal law requires that the game be played in Florida according to the rules laid down by the election on the date of the election. And what the characterization of the Florida Supreme Court's position as illegitimate is based on the notion that the Florida Supreme Court changed the rules laid down after the fact. The Florida legislature would be presumably doing the same thing if it were to change the rules and announce a different selection of electors after the fact, and would be subject to challenge for doing so. In the same way that Governor Bush has challenged the Florida Supreme Court. The question is there any court that could entertain that challenge? There is a doctrine, as you know, the political question doctrine or questions of justiciability that go to the question of whether courts may intervene with respect to matters that are are to be resolved finally by the legislative branch. We just saw an example with the impeachment process. The Senate decides finally whether to convict a sitting president and remove the president from office. It may be that the legislative branches here will speak the final word on the question of whether this particular slate of electors is legitimate or not.
We have many other callers. We'll continue. Next is Urbana line number 3. Hello.
Hello. First, I'd like to say I think you're trying very hard to be remain impartial in what is very difficult. But the reason I called was I think we have to be quite careful in saying that a Democrat is a Democrat in the Deep South in quite the way that Democrats are Democrats here in the North and Republicans are Republicans. The allegiance of some of the Southern Democrats is at least somewhat suspect as far as the main part of the Democratic Party. In fact, at least one of the state officers who is nominally Democratic backed Gore in this election. So you rather have to examine individual credentials, I suspect.
Okay. Well, we'll let our political scientists come in.
Well, the caller certainly has a point, that, though I think it's a somewhat more apropos point historically, that Democrats in the South certainly traditionally were much more conservative. The parties have been, since the late 60s or so, have been sort of sorting themselves out more ideologically, so that the conservative Southern Democrat is not extinct, but there are fewer and fewer of them. And I've been guilty myself of saying George Bush was successful in bipartisanship in Texas, but he was dealing with Texas Democrats. But you just have to look over the Texas House delegation, who are the Democrats from the House, and see that there are a number of genuine liberals in the delegation, that it isn't really so much true anymore, that all Southern Democrats are really more like Republicans who happen to just call themselves Democrats for historical reasons.
Do you want to say something? Okay. Let's go to another Urbana person here. This is line number 1. Hello.
Hello, I'm calling from Urbana. Listening to all of this talk, it seems like we lose track of the fact that if you look at the numbers in this year's election, the margin between the candidates is so incredibly small, it's below the margins of errors for accurately counting votes, even if you, you know, hold them up to the light and try to divine the intentions of the voters. So how, in a case like this, can the political process be resolved other than through either the courts or through the appropriate legislatures? And I'll just hang up and listen.
Okay.
It's an excellent point. I think it can't. I mean, we think about elections as being somehow perfect devices to measure the intent of the people. It's clear that they're imperfect in a number of ways. The voters can make mistakes, that the vote tabulators can make mistakes, that the machines can make mistakes. Normally, this is not important enough to pay any attention to, but this razor-thin margin just demonstrates that, in some respects, the best way to characterize a vote like this is that it was a tie. The candidates aren't going to agree to a coin toss at this point, so it's going to be resolved in a messy and inherently arbitrary way. And so I return to my kind of looking to the future point. Whoever ultimately comes out of this president is really going to have to be very, very careful to do anything possible to create a spirit of bipartisanship, to try somehow or other to come out of this bitterly divisive contest by with a series of proposals and programs that somehow can unite the parties. And I wouldn't want to be the advisor who has to draft that set of programs for him.
We'll go on again. Next caller is line number 2. This is Champagne. Hello. Is there a call there on line 2 in Champagne?
Oh, yes. Do you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, I just wanted to say I did not vote for Gore, but I think it's very clear that the butterfly ballot on election night certainly cost him the election. You probably saw the Newsweek graph showing that Buchanan got 3,500 votes, where he should have gotten only about 300. And if people assume that the butterfly ballot was fair, then you'd have to assume that 66 counties had normal intelligence in one county. All the stupid people were concentrated in one county. And that's probably also why the networks called the victory for Gore early, because they were depending on those exit polls where people thought they voted for Gore. And if there's any double voting, I would venture to say that there was virtually no double votes for Bush Buchanan, but if there are many, there would be many votes double voted for Gore Buchanan, because somebody just thought, you know, well, I goofed here, so I'll go ahead and vote for the other one. Probably didn't realize. And, you know, human nature being what it is, why they didn't go back for another ballot. So I think that no matter how, we're boxed in with the outcome here, no matter what, we have to accept it. But I think for the next 4 years, at least more than half the country will know, common sense-wise, that Gore did really win.
Thank you. All right. Thanks for the comment. Do you? I expect that in Florida they're going to be arguing about this for a long time. Do you think that in other places, other states, though, what's happened in Florida will lead local officials to approach the mechanics of elections differently?
Well, there's talk. I think it might help if Congress were able to put some money on the table. And make it available for local election officials and officers to use to upgrade equipment and so forth. I'm not sure how much money that would require, but it may be that some financial assistance will be forthcoming, and that might be a nice impetus to some local change.
Yeah, I expect a little, although just to play devil's advocate for a moment, that it's hard to conceive of an election system that's error-free. Canada just had an election, and they used a very old-fashioned, basically the same election system they've been using since 1867. You fill out pencil and paper, fill out an oval, and you're done. These punch cards are, anyone who works in computers knows it's an archaic technology, but if you bring in, say, computer voting, then there are going to be a number of, computer-phobic people who are concerned and who will later complain they made mistakes. And I don't think there's an electoral system in the world that somehow can prevent errors from happening one way or another.
We have about 10 minutes left. And again, our guests are Brian Gaines, professor of political science at U of I, Jim Fander, professor of law. We're talking about the presidential election. Your questions are welcome. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana, folks. Toll free anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Next up is Bloomington, Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hi. I'm disturbed by the statement made by one of your guests that he didn't know whether the Florida legislature would be permitted to determine the electors, even though our federal constitution clearly gives the legislature that power. When you say that the Florida legislature would not be permitted to do something, I think you're saying that a court, a group of unelected subjective judges, should overrule the actions of elected representatives of the people. Now, clearly, neither the legislators nor the judges are objective. They're both subjective. But the legislators are elected, and the judges are not. So when there's a contest between, in a democratic society, over who should prevail, shouldn't the elected officers prevail over the appointed officers?
I didn't mean to suggest that there was a clear answer to the question. What I intended to suggest is that there may be a contest in Florida and perhaps in the Congress of the United States about the relative primacy of the Florida courts and the Florida legislature. For me, it's an issue that's likely to be resolved by the language of the Constitution, and the Constitution gives some support for your position because it says that the elector shall be chosen in the manner the legislature shall direct.
Yeah.
It refers specifically to the legislature. And as you can imagine, Governor Bush's attorneys have made a fair amount of that reference, specific reference in the Constitution to the legislature. And they essentially say that the federal Constitution here overrides any assignment of authority to the Florida Supreme Court in the
right.
Florida Constitution and makes the Florida legislature dispositive on this question. Vice President Gore's attorneys counter by noting that other provisions that seemingly resemble that provision in the Constitution have been interpreted to treat the state as a state and to respect the assignment of authority that occurs under the terms of the state constitution, so that if the state constitution makes the Florida Supreme Court primary in terms of interpreting the law laid down and interpreting the meaning of the Florida Constitution, then that primacy would be carried over by the Constitution of the United States for purposes of resolving any contest over the selection of electors.
But
go ahead.
In that case, the Florida state constitution would trump our federal constitution. Normally, the federal constitution would prevail over a state constitution, wouldn't it?
Yes, indeed it would. And under the Supremacy Clause, controlling federal constitutional law will trump any state provision of law, whether it's state statutory law or state constitutional law. The question we don't know the answer to yet is whether the Supreme Court of the United States will treat that provision, which refers specifically to the legislature, as one that creates a regime of legislative primacy in the state legislature, or one that creates a system of respect for any rules that the legislature happens to lay down. Let me give you another example. The Article 1 says that the congressional district shall be and congressional elections shall be managed by the state legislature, subject to ultimate congressional control. And that provision has been interpreted not to create a regime of legislative primacy, so that if the state governor vetoes a statute, for example, that regulates congressional districts, the governor's veto is included in the legislative process. Another decision holds that state judicial interpretations may be included in the process as well. So I think it's hard to say how that provision of the Constitution will ultimately be interpreted. There are examples going both ways, and it's not even clear to me that the Supreme Court of the United States will be the final arbiter.
Well, thank you very much for your opinion.
Thanks.
It's somewhat confusing.
Thanks for the call. Well, it is confusing. Well, and also, conservatives for some time have been making the argument that the caller makes, saying that increasingly courts have been going beyond their appropriate role, usurping powers of legislatures and, in effect, making law. And I think that some people have said that the action of the Florida Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court in this case, this is the proverbial last straw, that things have finally gone too far. Does this add any fuel to these arguments over judicial activism and put any weight on the side of those people who make that argument that courts are going beyond their appropriate role?
I think it does. It has, the Florida Supreme Court's decision has certainly been portrayed as activist, as something other than just the routine interpretation of a conflict of state law. That was the way it was portrayed by Jim Baker when he characterized the court's opinion in the immediate aftermath of the Supreme Court decision. And that's certainly the position that Governor Bush's lawyers are taking before the Supreme Court of the United States. And I'm not sure that the Supreme Court itself, that is the Supreme Court of the United States, can allay those concerns entirely. Although many people have applauded the Supreme Court's decision to step in, hoping that its appearance of neutrality will lend some additional weight to the ultimate judicial resolution that appeared here. But I think you're quite right that courts have been seen with greater and greater frequency as the creatures of their political druthers.
Let's go to the next caller. That's line number 3 in Urbana. Hello.
Yeah, I've got 2 questions. I heard there were 400,000 absentee ballots in Florida, and that you don't even have to be a resident, and that you could be a resident of Georgia, for example, and still have an absentee ballot in Florida. They're that loose with the absentee ballots in Florida. And I was just wondering, is there any kind of opening there for the federal courts to get involved as far as, you know, absentee ballots and duplicate ballots and all that?
Again, I think the role for the federal courts here is going to be pretty limited. It seems to me that Florida law in the first instance is going to decide questions concerning the legality of the distribution of absentee ballots and the like. At some point, I suppose, if matters get sufficiently out of hand, federal issues might arise. Most obviously, if there is racial discrimination in the distribution or in the management of balloting. But short of that, I don't know that there's an obvious role for the federal courts.
Wow. And the other question I had, which may be shorter, is if the Supreme Court somehow overreaches in its decision here, like, for example, it seems likely that, I would think there'd be a lot of public criticism of any decision they made that seemed to overreach their, you know, their proper jurisdiction, I guess you'd call it, and we'd really be off the game board. But I'm just wondering do you think there really would be a lot of vocal public criticism from lawyers, political scientists, et cetera, if they did overreach?
I think the Supreme Court is going to be cautious in its disposition of this case, and is unlikely to stake out a position that will be easily characterized as an overreach. I think it's likely to be fairly careful, recognizing the expedited nature of the proceeding, the fact that it hasn't had a lot of time to study the issues. It's likely to try to frame a fairly narrow response to the issues presented.
I was going to go back to the question of absentee ballots. I think the immediate answer is that there's not really enough time for this likely to be an issue on which this election ultimately turns. The Electoral College deadline looms. In the aftermath of this election, as people are reconsidering election machinery, the mechanics of the election, there might be, across various states, some reconsideration of absentee ballot laws. They've become a little looser in recent years, basically because turnout is falling and legislatures and others have been looking for ways to make it easier to vote. There's a little bit of research that suggests that it does indeed increase fraud. There's kind of a trade-off here, but you make it a little easier to vote, you get more people voting, but then you also get an increase in fraud. So it's possible a couple of state legislatures will reconsider this and try to tighten up their absentee requirements. I don't know the specifics about allegations of fraud in the absentee ballots in Florida, but it's almost a certainty that there is some. And this sort of brings you to a fundamental political trade-off.
We've come close to the end of our time, and I'm afraid we're going to have to wrap it up with the promise I'm sure we'll continue to talk about these things for some time to come. But let me just take a minute to ask one question quickly on something we intend to try to explore on another program. After the election, when we appeared that we had this result where we had one candidate with the electoral votes to win and one candidate with the majority of the popular vote, there were some folks saying, well, we ought to get rid of the Electoral College. The system's antiquated. It doesn't make sense. The person who wins the popular vote ought to win the election. Do you think that it's likely that there's going to be any serious sort of discussion about getting rid of the Electoral College?
I think it's likely there will be some discussion. It's extraordinarily unlikely that the Electoral College will be abolished. And it's unlikely but somewhat more likely that one or two states might follow the Maine and Nebraska example and not give all of their electors by the winner-take-all system, whereby if you win the popular vote by one vote in the state, you get all electors. States are free to give out the electors in a more proportional manner. One or two states might do so. I don't think many will, and I'm all but certain the Electoral College will not be abolished.
Jim essentially nodding his head. You agree. All right. Well, I want to say thanks very much to our guests, Brian Gaines, Professor of Political Science, Jim Fender, Professor of Law, both from University of Illinois. Thank you both very much for being here.
My pleasure.
Thanks.